When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Our theme today is the Netherlands. You might remember that New York City was called New Amsterdam from 1624 to 1664. However, in 1664, the British captured New Amsterdam and renamed it New York. 9 years later, in 1673, the city changed hands once again when the Dutch recaptured it during the Third Anglo-Dutch War, but the city was returned to Britain in 1674 at the end of the war. You might also remember that Dutch settlers remained in New York after the various Anglo-Dutch wars, and many became leading figures in American history. Of course, I'm thinking about President Martin Van Buren, President Teddy Roosevelt, and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Indeed, the Roosevelts were the fourth great-grandsons of a man by the name of Nicolaas Van Rozenfelt, who was born in New Amsterdam way back in 1658. Now, in this series, we have only really referenced the Netherlands once in the episode about Jewish life in the colonies, and we learned that the first known Dutch Jews arrived in New Amsterdam way back in 1654. In short, Dutch people have made up the tapestry of New York City and the United States from the very beginning. But what part did these early Dutch Americans play in the American Revolution? What did they think about those political ideals expressed in the Declaration? That all men are created equal? That they are endowed with inalienable rights? And how did the Declaration affect all of the other Dutch colonies around the world? And how did the Dutch back in the Netherlands react to the Declaration of Independence? So today we have a lot of questions about Dutch American history to answer, and I'm very happy to have a fantastic expert to help me answer them. Professor Matthijs Tieleman. Welcome, Matthijs.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great that you're here. Matthijs is assistant professor of history at Illinois State University. His book, The Patriot Atlantic, The Dawn of the Age of Revolution, forthcoming with the University of Virginia Press, examines the transatlantic connections between the revolutionary patriot movements in North America, Ireland, and the Netherlands. He has also published essays on transatlantic perspectives and the American Revolution in academic journals such as the Journal of Early American Studies. So, you chose a very famous passage from the Declaration of Independence as your introductory quotation, but you argue that there is a specifically Dutch or international twist to that passage. So why don't you tell me about that Dutch and international twist, please?
Yes, there's a number of Dutch twists to the history of the American Revolution, of course. I chose this particular passage not so much for its necessarily Dutch connection, although there is some, but the important passage here, and this is something that famous scholar Lige Gould has made in his book a couple of years ago, which is that one of the purposes of the Declaration of Independence and of American independence writ large, but particularly of the Declaration, was basically a signal to the rest of the world saying, we want to be an equal nation among nations, right? Particularly among European nations. And of course, you know, the Declaration of Independence is only the start of independence. If nobody actually recognizes independence, it has zero meaning. It's just someone putting something on paper. And so what this passage does in the very beginning of the Declaration is say that they want to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station of natural law, meaning that they are an equal nation among other nations. And so when you look at the history of the American Revolution, the first country, of course, to recognize American independence was France in 1778. But France largely did it for geopolitical purposes. The second country to recognize the United States was the Dutch Republic, the country that which is what we call the Netherlands at this particular point in time in the early 1780s. And the Dutch Republic did it largely for ideological reasons, for the fact that they supported the United States in its beliefs system. And so thanks to the Dutch, in part, the United States became one of those powers of the earth.
Yeah, it's funny. The declaration of anything means nothing unless it is acknowledged by others. So in a certain respect, that opening passage is asking everyone to, it's like if you say hi to someone on the street, you want them to say hello back. And if they say hello back, it acknowledges you.
Exactly. And ironically, it means the most if Britain recognizes it, right? So that's the ironic part there. If Britain actually recognizes that, hey, this is a separate country, then the floodgates open. But that, of course, would take until the end of the war.
Right. So the Dutch Republic recognized the United States before the end of the Revolutionary War. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yes. Yes. The American Revolutionary War, in fact, extends to the Dutch Republic in 1780. Britain declares war on the Dutch Republic in late 1780, lasting until late 1783. This is called the Fourth Anglo-Dutch War. In your introduction, you referred to earlier Anglo-Dutch wars. This is the last and fourth one, the Fourth Anglo-Dutch War. And it was essentially an extension of the American Revolutionary War on the North Sea. It was a naval war.
Okay, well, we might get to that later, but I think we need to hit a pause and go back to the beginning.
Sure.
So why don't you provide me just with a quick overview of the Dutch in North America, and also you wanted to talk a little bit about Americans in the Dutch Republic, but why don't you just talk about Dutch in North America first?
Yeah, so you mentioned in your introduction the presence of Dutch people in the American colonies, and they were certainly present still by the 18th century. Towns like Albany, which was called Beverwijk by the Dutch colonists when it was still New Netherland, right, in the 17th century, was basically a Dutch town. So you had, this was kind of a frontier town, lots of fur trade. So you had large settlements in the state of New York, or in the colony of New York, rather, that still retained a lot of its Dutchness, despite the fact that the British had taken over before. And there were, you know, interconnections. Alexander Hamilton married into a famous, you know, patroon family, you know, and there were others where these sort of Dutch groups were still pretty prominent. You mentioned President Martin Van Buren in the, you know, late 1830s. He was from one of those families, and so it was even into the 19th century that this continued. At the same time, I think the Dutch presence in the colonies, mostly in terms of at least connecting to American independence and the American Revolution, largely the most important element of that was the trading connections, meaning the amount of Dutch merchants actually coming from the Netherlands, from the Caribbean, to American ports to trade. And this is really what connects the Dutch and the Dutch Republic to this larger conflict that would become American independence.
Just a quick follow-up about to what extent the Dutch settlers, I use the word integration because I don't have a better word, sort of integrated into sort of the new British customs once it goes back. And I'm thinking of a parallel maybe with the French Canadians. It took a while for the French Canadians to figure out how to coexist with their new British rulers.
If ever.
Yeah, if ever. Good point.
Yeah.
If but they did, you know, they sided with the king during the Revolutionary War. But
true.
Were the Dutch settlers, and now I'm going back to what year was the final transfer again
in the 1670s?
Right. So in 1674, Britain takes over for good, at least until it becomes an independent nation, the United States.
Yes.
Was there some sort of resentment there, or were the colonists, much like the French Canadian colonists, kind of more interested in their farm, their trade around them, than wider political issues happening way back in Europe.
The English really retain a lot of the systems that the Dutch had put in place. Now, James II, you know, reorganizes New York eventually incorporates it into the Dominion. But the resentment there, and there was, you know, there after the Glorious Revolution of 1688, you get pushback from local Dutch militia leaders, but there's nothing particularly Dutch about that necessarily, in the sense that you'd probably find, you know, they would probably be not too happy about British rule, but or English rule. But a lot of the systems were kept in place. I mean, the patroon system, which was kind of foundational to Dutch New York, which is a kind of a feudal system of labor exploitation and land grants, that system stayed in place forever, even into the United States. I mean, there were patroon families going all the way into the 19th century. The Schulers, right, that Hamilton married into, was one of those. That system sort of retained its value. Although it's like they didn't, the West India Company did not, I don't think, like, well, the West India Company lost control after the English took over. And so the patroon system, which granted land based on how many settlers you brought, I think they ended that, but the patroons were not, you know, they didn't take away the land. They still could exploit it.
It sounds like the seigneur system in France. I'm sorry, the seigneur system in Canada, rather. When after the British took over in Canada, the French seigneurs who had, again, like a feudal system like this patroon system, of course, they wanted to maintain that system, the ruling French Canadians. And so yes, they kept it in Canada, too.
Yeah, there wasn't some kind of major purge of ruling elites. It just continued and got displaced eventually with other English elites. And keep in mind, Dutch New York or the New Netherland was always very diverse. I mean, you talked about the Jewish, most of those Jewish people were Portuguese Jews kicked out of Brazil. There were Belgians, there were Flemish people, you know, Germans. It was a quite diverse colony. Enslaved Africans, of course. So it wasn't just Dutch people, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. But suffice it to say, in 1775, so now at the start of the Revolutionary War, would you just say that the distinction between being a Dutch New Yorker and an English New Yorker, most of those distinctions had kind of fallen away?
Yeah. You can kind of see it as a large minority subgroup that had been absorbed into the British imperial system.
But they're English-speaking.
And Dutch-speaking.
And Dutch-speaking, and they're intermarrying.
Yes. I mean, obviously, with Hamilton, you see that.
Yeah. So by 1775, there are Dutch North Americans, but
yes,
it's not a sort of separate community.
Right. Yeah, that's right. By the early 19th century, they start to let go of their Dutchness, and then later you get a new surge in Michigan and places like that. That's later colonists. That's not the connection with the old colony. Yeah.
Okay. Good. And why don't we just cast our view back to the Netherlands or the Dutch Republic? Now, you mentioned that there are Americans in the Dutch Republic that are worth mentioning.
Yes. Well, the American colonists were active traders. And so what you see happening is that you have Dutch traders in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, right? Charleston, they go all over the place. They're flying the Dutch flag. But you also see American colonial traders going to the Dutch Republic. And it is, in fact, the trade in Dutch tea that creates the famous Boston Tea Party, right? The dumping of the tea in Boston. It's all these connections that the British, what you see happening is while they're cracking down after the passing of the Townshend Acts in 1767 and 1768, they don't just crack down on traders, you know, on smugglers or trying to crack down on supposed smugglers in North America, but they do the same thing in the Dutch Republic. So they, you know, you see the British government, who was friendly with the stadtholder, who was kind of the executive of the Dutch Republic. He was the cousin of George III, they're trying to crack down on these traders, and they're you know, these merchants. They send letters to the Dutch government saying, hey, there's this smuggling ship from Rhode Island coming in. I'm pretty sure that those guys are shipping stuff that they're not supposed to, right? And then because the Dutch Republic was very decentralized in terms of control, the stadtholder did not actually have the authority to just say, oh, yeah, let's search that ship, right? So by the time that they got around to it, if they ever did, a lot of times those ships were emptied in the middle of the night, or they had already left, or, you know. So you see that the enforcement of British imperial policy extends all the way into the Dutch Republic. And this becomes even more problematic during the war, when, you know, after the events of the Tea Party and the coercive acts that cracked down on Massachusetts and tried to force them to pay, there's lots of weapon smuggling. So the Dutch provide lots and lots of firearms, lots and lots of ammunition, gunpowder to the Patriot rebels. And so you see the British continue that policy into the mid-1770s, late 1770s, because it's the Dutch that are providing the American colonists and the revolutionaries with weapons. The British get real frantic about this. They're even afraid that the Dutch are building the American Navy. So, you know, they have their spies looking for this stuff. Some of it was just, you know, paranoia, but a lot of it was real. They were, in fact, trading this stuff.
Well, the Dutch had a long history of supplying arms to both sides of a conflict.
Correct.
In North America. In the French and Indian War, they were supplying
Correct.
Arms to both Indians who supported the French and Indians who supported the English, and they really weren't supposed to.
Correct. Yes, that's correct. Although they weren't supposed to, according to the British. But then that's the thing. So there was a legal vagueness there. So according to the treaty that ended, I think, the Second Anglo-Dutch War, there was basically free trade, or there was at least no limitations on the kind of articles that could be traded, except during times of war when contraband goods were not allowed. But it wasn't specified what those contraband goods were, right? And so what is a contraband good? Well, weapons, sure, but material to build up your navy, you know, wood, rope, you know, like, so that gets real vague real fast. And the Dutch were really keen on exploiting that in the Seven Years' War, which is why the British cracked down on it in the 1760s. The exact same reason. They knew that the Dutch were supplying their enemies for profit. And the Dutch were basically saying, well, look, I mean, in the treaty, it says contraband goods. But, you know, if I'm supplying, you know, timber, is that really a contraband good, right? And so you see them get dragged to court. And so that creates a lot of resentment in the Dutch Republic among merchants, which helps sustain and create like a foundation once the American colonists rise up and they declare independence. That's when you see that support all of a sudden, you know, solidify and actually provides material support, continued material support to the American colonies and the American revolutionaries.
Yeah, that's funny. It just going now to current politics, I think the word we would use now is dual use items.
Yes.
Like in
yes.
modern sanctions against like the Iranian nuclear program. Can this item also be used in whatever it is, a computer chip to run a centrifuge or not? And
Correct.
So obviously,
yeah.
And people might, you know, traders might justifiably say, well, who's to say it's dual use? I mean, I guess toilet
yes.
paper could be used in multiple ways too.
Correct. Yeah, it's exactly the same reasoning. But then, of course, it's really funny. The British also sometimes don't know, right? So they hunt down ships that have Dutch flags on them. But then they're, you know, sometimes merchants get dragged to British Admiralty courts. You have people who are pro-British complain that, but I'm pro-British. I hate the Americans. They get dragged to court anyway, which costs them lots of money because their ship is docked for weeks at a time. They have to hire lawyers. They have to go through all this process and all these things. So it creates a lot of problems. And in modern times, sanctions, I mean, the effectiveness of sanctions is debatable. But it's incredibly difficult to enforce now, but it's even more difficult to enforce when you're just using sails and a bunch of guys on a massive ocean.
Right.
So that's why they crack down in the ports, because that's where, you know, everybody comes, basically.
Okay, one final follow-up on Americans in the Dutch Republic around this time. So before the start of the Revolutionary War, were the North American traders who were not of Dutch descent trading in the Netherlands or in the Dutch Republic, were they self-identifying as like North Americans or as British?
They typically would identify themselves by their colony or their place of birth.
So even more specifically, they would be like, I'm a trader from Virginia.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And that's how it would be logged typically. So you would like, if you would have a shipping log, it would say port destination, not nation necessarily, but yeah, they would consider themselves part of British subjects, but a Massachusetts man or a, mm-hmm. a Virginia man.
No.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And these colonial traders are also bringing news, of course, from the colonies to the Dutch Republic, right?
Yeah, well, the news element, that is a whole vein of interesting. I wrote an article about it too. And that's right, they brought news, and they, when the revolution breaks out, they completely integrate themselves into the Dutch press, which is at this point in the 18th century, the most important press in the Western world. Anybody who's anybody read Dutch newspapers, because the Dutch Republic was one of the few countries where there was the freedom of the press. And so there were all these big time newspapers, often French language. The biggest one was Gazette de Leiden, or the Leiden Gazette. It had an official name, but that was what it was officially called. And it was run by a guy called Jean Luzac. And that newspaper, Luzac was very intimate with the American founders. And they pushed, not just there, they pushed in a bunch of newspapers, pushed pro-American material in. So before this revolution, so you have these merchants, sure, they bring news and that would be reported. But it's really when the revolution breaks out that really becomes an avenue for the American revolutionaries to basically have their story told in the European and global press, really.
That's fascinating. Okay, let's move on to our second big point today. We just want to look at perspectives about the Declaration of Independence amongst Dutch colonists in the United States or in the colonies at the time, and then Dutch colonists in the wider Dutch Empire too. And the reason why I had this question for you is because I'm thinking if Dutch colonists now in the British colonies are very keen on being independent, I'm also kind of wondering in the wider Dutch Empire, where there weren't revolutions, I don't think until much later, how they're reacting to this declaration of independence from their brethren now in the British colonies, though.
Yeah. So by and large, and then this is sort of gets back to the point we were talking about earlier with this conception of them being like just sort of accepting their position as initially as British subjects within the Dutch American community in North America, there are plenty of patriots. There presumably were also plenty of loyalists. There's not a particularly in the colonies themselves anyway. It's not like the Dutch were the most, you know, most strong patriots there were, or neither were there the strongest loyalists necessarily. So their reaction was mixed, the same as it was in every other colony and every other group. I mean, we do know that the revolutionaries reached out to these communities. So you see, I mean, Ben Franklin had a German language newspaper, right? I mean, these existed. And there were also, I know of rumors, but I've never actually found it, of a Dutch translation in the colonies of the Declaration of Independence itself. But I'm sure that it was translated because they did do those things. And I've also seen Dutch ministers speaking in support in pamphlets in their sermons, which were then reprinted. So you do see support there, obviously. But I've never read anybody ever saying about the Dutch Americans specifically, hey, these are the biggest supporters of the revolution. I haven't seen that. But neither have I seen the other side saying, oh, those guys are really real big loyalists by and large.
Well, I think that makes sense. From again, yeah. Now I'm going back to the Canadian perspectives and why Canada did not join the Declaration of Independence. The people who you might expect to be loyalists weren't necessarily loyalists. And the people you might expect to be patriots weren't necessarily patriots, because there is a very much a mix of your economic interest. Sometimes religious belief came into this. There are all different reasons why you might choose one side or another. And it's just hard, especially if the Dutch settlers had now integrated fully. Some probably had really strong business relationships, maybe with the British government, right? And yeah. It would have been bad for them to put those at risk. So it totally makes sense that there was a mixed view amongst Dutch Americans about how to react to the Declaration of Independence. So why don't you just now talk about the other Dutch colonies? How did they react to news of this Declaration of Independence?
Well, the biggest reaction came in the Caribbean, in the Dutch Caribbean, right? So the Netherlands now, as then, had a set of islands. Now they are a relatively small group of countries, mostly tourism, right? But at the time, a particular place that the American colonists used extensively for this trade that I mentioned was the island of Saint Eustatius, right? And that's an island. It's a small, very small island, basically a volcanic island, and that was, the British called, the nest of pirates, right? It was pirates and smugglers. It was the you know, if you ever seen Pirates of the Caribbean, right, that scene with Tortuga, you know, where they go. It wasn't really like that, but that's kind of the image that they portrayed this place as, right? The Dutch West India Company ran a smuggling ring here, and this is where all the weapons went, this is where all the tea went, this is where everything went, right? And so, and the Americans knew this, right? And at a certain point in September of 1776, because the U.S. Navy gets created, and it's kind of a haphazard thing, they basically refit merchant vessels and put a bunch of guns on them and tried to stop this massive navy. And one of these ships that goes and gets refitted is the USS Andrew Doria, which sails from Philadelphia, I believe, down to St. Eustatius and flying the rebel flag, and gets received by Fort Orange at St. Eustatius with an honorary salute. So one of the things they did in the 18th century was, when you met another ship and you recognized someone's flag, you basically gave a number of shots, right? So you sort of fired your cannon a number of times, and then I think you gave one or two shots extra or something like this to recognize the other, to sort of, it's like an honorary salute. And the Dutch fort answered the 13 shots for each of the independent colonies, answered with an honorary salute from the fort. But of course, that's weird, because they were recognizing a flag of a nation that nobody recognized, right? This is 1776. They would just, and so the people, the Americans, sort of framed this as, whoa, someone's recognizing our flag. We're recognized. And even today, you see that the Dutch government kind of brags about this, that, oh, we recognized them first, which isn't really true. It was mostly that
the pirates in St. Eustatius recognized them first.
yeah, exactly. It's just the governor of the WIC over there, he was like, well, these are our good customers. What are we supposed to do? But the British were incensed. But this is called the first salute controversy. And, you know, the British demand that, when they hear about it back home, they demand the Dutch government that he gets recalled, that he gets fired. He has to answer all these questions about why he did this. And this is one of those things, right? I talked about earlier about that war that breaks out in 1780. This is one of those first instances or one of many diplomatic disputes that happen. And so you see that dynamic happening in the Dutch colonies where they're just sort of like going along with these rebels, but creating lots of problems for the Dutch.
That's a super interesting story. It's almost like an 18th century social media kerfuffle. But what's amazing about it is that it was somehow reported, right?
Yeah.
Back then, and someone must have written in a newspaper about this, and then somehow that newspaper, or maybe there was a British spy there or something, after months sent that all the way back to London for someone then to be offended by it.
No. In fact, St. Eustatius, it's wild. I mean, the British hated St. Eustatius. In fact, I think it's Admiral Rodney, I think his name is, who, when they were supposed to reinforce British troops at Yorktown at the end of the war, Rodney is so pissed off that he actually doesn't go on time. He goes to St. Eustatius, captures it, loots the whole place. Also, he was a pretty big anti-Semite, and there were quite a few Jewish merchants there, treated them horribly, and shows up too late at Yorktown to save the British troops, right? So it's the British hated St. Eustatius with a visceral hate. It was quite extensive, and it particularly that first salute thing that really pushed them over the edge on that.
That's super funny. But the people there, and this is kind of the point that I've been driving at, the Dutch in St. Eustatius did not want to be independent from the Dutch Republic in the way that the American colonists did. And so I'm just trying to get at the nature of the relationship between the Dutch colonists in Dutch Republic colonies, why that relationship was different, why they weren't so angry about their imperial master, so to say, as the American patriots were angry about King George. That's kind of what I'm trying to get at here.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great question. Well, I mean, what you see happening is that at the time, there is a patriot movement going on in the Dutch Republic as well. And what's interesting about this, I think that looking back, we view the American Revolution as an anti-colonial struggle, but it really wasn't. It was at first a struggle for British rights, for the restoration of British rights that they felt that had been, that's why they call themselves patriots to begin with. It's about the restoration of British constitutional rights. And when they don't get it, they rise up in revolt to establish a government based on natural rights, but that is supposed to basically replace this British model, right? And in fact, in many ways, the American constitutional system that follows has a lot of similarities with the British model, right? So there's a lot of continuities there. And so in the Dutch, in St. Eustatius and other Dutch colonies, it's not like what you see in the 20th century, where you have anti-colonial struggles happening everywhere, and people are like, oh yeah, we are a colony and we want our own country. Rather, you see in St. Eustatius, but also in the Dutch Republic itself, they see it as an anti-British struggle and an anti-tyrannical struggle and a pro-free trade struggle, right? About trying to liberate trade on the Atlantic from British attempts to stifle it in a time, and this is important, in a time when the Dutch economy was not doing well, and the only bright spot was the trade on the Atlantic, right? And so they were trying to crush, in the Dutch mind, they were trying to crush this trade. And so that's the thing, how they view it. They view it as a struggle against British tyranny and British attempts to establish sovereignty on the Atlantic. And so they look at the American colonists and they understand that, A, they are fighting to restore their rights, which is what they wanted to do as well, to restore the former glory, liberty in the Dutch Republic. They're looking at their mercantile systems and they're saying, yeah, we are, for one, we are literally, there's economic interest, we are literally tied But also, we suffer under the same consequences. We're dragged to the same courts. They're taking our troops, which we can get into later. They're trying to recruit basically Dutch troops for the war, right? So they're trying to take our money. And so it's an anti-British struggle that they're identifying with, not so much the anti-colonial dynamic. They're not looking and thinking, oh, that happens to us too. No, they're thinking, no, that happens to us too, but it's the British that are doing it to us, not the Dutch government necessarily.
Yeah, I love that explanation. It ties together so much here. The importance of free trade in the Atlantic for all these groups of from farmers who need some place to sell their goods to the merchants themselves, to the sailing vessels, to the people who make sailing ships, and on and on and on.
Yes.
And also yes. This concept that there's an argument to make. I'm not wholly on board with your argument that the American patriots were conservative in the sense that they were trying to restore rights they had that they were lost, because that doesn't explain the perspective of someone like Thomas Paine and all the true idealistic believers who were struggling to get equality because all men are created equal. And that's where I want to take my next question to you. So sure. You mentioned all of these very, you know, the anti-British reason that the Dutch and St. Eustatius supported the American patriots, free trade, of course, dislike of British tyranny. To what extent, when they are reading the most famous lines of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, are they sympathizing with the political ideals expressed in the Declaration of Independence?
The Dutch patriots, yes. So much like the American colonists, the concept of natural law and natural rights and the state of nature, which is what created equal references, right? It's equality in nature. Yeah, they identify with this because, well, for one thing, Dutch writers were essential to the concept of natural law. Hugo Grotius is a major thinker on this. And it's not just him, Barlow McQuee, there's lots of guys. But this was a cosmopolitan concept of the Enlightenment that they identified with. And so they saw that definitely, and I identified with it. Now, there was also the element of the fact that you had the Dutch themselves in the 1560s, so 200 years earlier, had fought a kind of war of independence from the Spanish. And so there is a Declaration of Independence that called Act of Abjuration. It might be fun for listeners to read that in English, because it's got a lot of elements that come back. And it's much more of a 16th century document. But the way that it's structured is obviously something that people like Jefferson followed, right? And in fact, when this declaration comes to the Netherlands and they hear about this, the stadtholder folks, right, the pro-British side, the stadtholder, there's a letter, it's really funny, he calls it a parody of the Dutch Act of Abjuration. You know, he says, this is just a poor fake copy. Like, this is a poor facsimile, he calls it. You know, it's a parody. But the patriots, and this is what the Dutch patriots do, but you see the American patriots do too, they look back to the past and they say, this is what we want to restore, right? This is, the Dutch are similarly engaged in the sort of central object of their political system of liberty, right? And so they see that too. They see that connection and they sort of see, hey, these Americans, they're trying to do this, the same thing we did back then, and we need to do it again, right? We need to restore that system that we once put in place, this constitution that we then put in place.
So I just want to follow up on this and going back to my previous comment about Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine, in common sense, is very much pro-natural law, and nothing in natural law, he says, indicates that there should be hereditary kings or lords. He says that's
sure.
Antithetical to all natural law stuff. But
correct.
The Dutch Republic, has the Dutch Republic at this point in 1775, well, you still have a hereditary monarch. So to what extent
Really? Well, that's complicated, but yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm getting at is the complicated part of this. I mean, to what extent when we're talking about natural law indicates that no one should be born to be king of anything, according to Thomas Paine and many other American patriots. How do we then understand that complicated concept of the Dutch being for natural law and equal rights, and yet having the very unnatural law traditions of sure. kings? And we don't have to talk about the present, but I'm more interested in what's going on in the Dutch Republic in 1775, 1776.
Sure, yeah, yeah. The theory of natural law is completely compatible with monarchy. So, and the Enlightenment is completely compatible with monarchy. There were enlightened monarchs. There were enlightened despots, even. Thomas Paine is not really, well, for one thing, he's not really an American in the sense that that's kind of a dispute. But he was definitely on the more radical side. And in fact, what you see happening is that his common sense happens at the right time. But even the Declaration of Independence repudiates a lot of the things that Paine is doing. And then you see others trying to repudiate it even further, like Adams in Thoughts on Government. So yes, Thomas Paine's common sense, he would be an example of a very progressive patriot, and by the 1790s, he's just a full-on radical. And the Americans reject him. I mean, he's not appreciated for the fact that he basically hates Christianity. And, no. You know, he goes full out on this. So monarchy and hereditary systems and aristocracy and elite systems are completely compatible with natural law. So as I explain this, I'm going to use two terms here. One is the Dutch Patriot Movement, which was a movement that emerged in the 1770s, and there was a revolution in the 1780s, from 1781 more or less to 1787, so at the same time as the American Revolutionaries, and inspired by the American Revolutionaries. The other term that I'm going to use is the Stadtholder, or the Orangists, which were the group associated with the Stadtholder. And the Stadtholder was effectively an executive office of the Dutch Republic. So he was the commander of the military, but he also had lots of influence in appointing local officials, Orangists, really, those who supported him. And so, yeah, he was kind of a mixture of a king and a president, sort of all combined. And they were famously attached to the Orange family, right, which is also currently the king. King of the Netherlands is also the Orange family. Yeah, so the Dutch Republic at this point does not have a hereditary monarchy. In 1747, there's a revolution also done by patriots, the Orangist patriots, too long to get into. They restore the stadtholdership, basically, and they make it hereditary. It used to be an elected position by the various provincial estates, but in 1747, they make the stadtholderate hereditary. Now, this is the first time in Dutch history that happened. And this line of Orange stadtholder, so the Orange line, would become the monarchs of the current Kingdom of the Netherlands. But yeah, the Dutch patriots, like the Irish patriots, and also like the American patriots until it was inconvenient in late 1775, were pro-stadtholder / monarch. They celebrated George III, they celebrated the stadtholder. So even the most radical Dutch patriots, well, there were probably some, but they were really, really limited. Not that I've ever seen anyway. In the 1780s, they say, yeah, the stadtholder's great. We don't want it. They didn't even want to touch the hereditary stuff, which actually surprised me. They just said he's too powerful. He needs to be limited. His power needs to be limited. The constitution needs to be restored to its original setting. And this was all imagined, by the way. This is not like this was the actual constitution. This is just what they imagined it to be. But that was their argument, that it needed to be limited. And they didn't get what they wanted, but because the revolution failed. But yeah, so there is a compatibility there between, it's just, if you would take Paine and apply it fully, they wouldn't agree with any of that, or not with any, but they wouldn't agree with that full anti-monarchy stance. They wouldn't agree with that repudiation of history, the universality of it. But they agreed with the anti-British nature, which was what, of course, common sense was.
Okay. I'm going to press this point on the all men are created equal passage in the
sure.
in the Declaration of Independence.
Sure.
Because, again, that is the ideologically pure concept there. And the way you've just described sort of Dutch interpretations of Enlightenment principles is that sort of all men are created equal in a limited constitutional monarchy. So with lots of caveats there. So, yeah, so again, that, I'm just wondering to what extent are the Dutch in the Dutch Republic looking at that political ideal and really saying, in the way kind of we interpret it now, all men are created equal, all men are created equal, full stop. And so, of course, and maybe then this might be a way for us to talk a little bit about slavery in the Dutch Republic and the Dutch colonies, too.
Sure. Well, this is how the Americans interpret it, too, at least in my view. When they say created equal, it's in natural law, but they believed in natural aristocracy. This is why they kept slavery in place. This is why the Irish patriots kept Catholics, because these were mostly Protestant in Ireland, but they didn't try to undermine that system, right? They didn't try to elevate Catholics. And the Dutch patriots, they mostly doled out power to other patriots. They said that Orangists, so those who supported the stadtholder, were not true Dutchmen. If you wanted to vote, you needed to be a member of the militia, which were all patriots, right? So the concept of equality, this is something that really becomes more of a thing after the French Revolution, which is why Paine latches onto it as strongly as he does. But that kind of egalitarian nature, it's in dispute. It's not a common understanding. Now, were some Dutch patriots against slavery? Yes. So you see the biggest proponent of the Dutch patriots, sort of the intellectual leader, very long name, Johan Derk van der Capelle tot den Pool, van der Capelle, usually called. He was a nobleman. Obviously, nobody was arguing about getting rid of aristocracy, and neither were the American revolutionaries, really, because there was no noble system officially, but the aristocracy, the southern slave planters were effectively the aristocracy, but nobody was arguing for getting rid of those. He makes the argument that, yeah, slavery is bad, and we should get rid of it in the colonies. This is not a good thing. Was there a big movement? No. Do you see it in North America? Yes. In Pennsylvania, they do the Gradual Abolition Act. In Massachusetts, you have a bunch of freedom suits that overturn slavery in Massachusetts. In South Carolina, no. Right? So the overall consensus was that the slave trade, the Atlantic slave trade, was really bad. And that's why it's in the Constitution, where they were sort of talking about maybe get rid of it, but if we get rid of it now, it's kind of bad because it's bad for our business, for the South. So let's put a ban on banning it for 25 years, right? And then you can't amend it. And then only then can Congress ban it. And they do, right? In the early 19th century, they ban it. So this equality clause, whether it's gender equality, racial equality, social economic equality, these were all inequalities that were part of society, not nature, and therefore were not attacked or not. And there were, and again, there were critiques on this, but this was a societal question that needed to be dealt with gradually, with prudence, with what they called virtue, and not completely removed the way that the French revolutionaries would eventually argue that should happen.
Or Thomas Paine.
Right, or Thomas Paine, right. But you see, I mean, if you look at what Thomas Paine is writing in Common Sense, he's not arguing for the end of slavery.
That's true.
So Thomas Paine radicalizes further, but he was too extreme for many. It's just his argument against monarchy at a time when George III had declared the colonies rebels meant that his argument for independence, which is what Common Sense ultimately was very strong. But nobody takes Paine up on his idea for constitutions. They think right. It's ridiculous.
Right.
So Paine's influence insofar as that he says, yes, Britain is bad, monarchy is bad, that gets taken up, yeah.
Okay, good. So as you've been talking about all this something in the back of my mind that I wanted to ask you about is the importance of religion and the Dutch attitudes to religion, specifically with respect to the Declaration of Independence and religious freedom, and how that might intertwine both in the colonies and back in the Dutch Republic.
Yes. Yeah, so one of the interesting things is that what you see is patriotism first, these ideas really that form the American Revolution, that form the Dutch Patriot Revolution, and the Irish as well, is that they first take shape in places where Protestantism has traditionally held sway. In the 18th century, you see that religion doesn't go away, and of course there's the Great Awakening and all these other moments, but it sort of disappears into the background, at least of political thought and political practice, and religious, the idea of religious liberty and freedom becomes more prominent. It becomes more of a goal that is followed by these patriots. And so the interesting thing that you're seeing is that particularly in North America, that some colonies, some states, when they form their constitutions, they embed Protestantism in there. You see this mostly in New England, right? They, you know, the Massachusetts Constitution privileges Protestants heavily, right? They give state funds to Protestant schools, right? But not Catholic schools, because I mean, we associate Boston so much with the Irish now that it's hard to imagine Boston without Catholics, but there was a time when it was, right? Processions were banned for a really long time. But if you look at Virginia, it's a lot less so because of just that Protestant identity was not as strongly embedded in there. And so when they create the federal constitution later on, they kind of keep it neutral. They kind of keep it flat. But a lot of these state constitutions, there was a lot of intermingling with religion and politics. And in the Dutch Republic, you see similar things, and very strongly in Ireland. That's where it's really, really, really strong. That Protestant-Catholic dynamic is especially strong. But yeah, that's totally intermingled. These theories of religious freedom kind of come from these Protestant places where you have a lot of divergence, this sort of splintering of all these different Protestant groups. Some of them are very strict and orthodox, but others are very liberal, right? And mostly those liberal types, like Hugo Grotius, right? These natural law thinkers, they take it into the religious freedom direction.
Yeah, but so to what extent are sort of Dutch Enlightenment ideas or Dutch American settlers, how much are they sort of very much interested on the one hand in having religious freedom, or are they more concerned with Protestantism, preserving their Protestant privileges?
Oh, that's a good question. It really depends on whom you ask. I would say that at least in the colonies in the Northeast, it's more the Protestantism thing. In the middle colonies in the South, so like basically south of Pennsylvania and south of that, it's less strong. It's more religious freedom. You get more of a religious freedom dynamic there.
And you know, the Dutch nowadays are known for religious freedom.
Yes, sort of, and also a lack of it.
A
lack of religion. I mean, it's a pretty
a lack of religion. Yeah.
But
are we sensing that already back in the Dutch Republic in 1776, for example, a turn towards religious freedom?
Oh yeah, religious freedom was already a thing way back in the 17th century. But again, this is limited. But for the early modern period, this was very extensive. So while Catholics were not, even though it was the largest religious group, which most people don't realize, that's still true today. Actually, the largest denomination, because there's so many Protestant denominations. But yeah, the Catholics were not allowed to practice in public, but they were allowed to practice. Which wasn't the case in Germany, right, where you either had a Protestant state or a Catholic state, or in Spain, where you had to be a Catholic, right? So there was a form of religious freedom. The pilgrims, right, the guys who create Plymouth Colony, that's sort of a big myth in American history, that they went to North America for religious freedom. But they didn't. They went to the Dutch Republic for religious freedom, but then their kids started to become more Dutch, and they were, you know, becoming urbanized, and they started speaking Dutch and started interacting with non-English people. And so these pilgrims were looking for a place where they could have religious freedom and be English at the same time. So that's why they left the Dutch Republic. So the religious freedom was huge in the Dutch Republic way earlier than it was in North America, way earlier than it was in England and in Ireland, certainly. And so you see that religion itself in the Dutch Republic doesn't polarize. So you don't see the patriots say, oh, those guys are not true Protestants or something. In fact, it's not an issue at all. Whereas it's a huge issue in Ireland. That's the issue, Catholic, Protestant. And it's a subliminal or a, maybe that's a too complicated of a word, but a kind of effervescent issue, I guess, in the North American colonies, where the general census is religious freedom, but they also kind of tolerate the Protestant dominance in New England, right? I mean, this separation between church and state, yes, it happens on a federal level in the Constitution, but I mean, Massachusetts, no way. I mean, there's right. just the, and it makes sense because Massachusetts was created as a religiously intolerant. I mean, it was for a particular congregation, right? And so you see that echo through history.
Okay, good. We just have a couple more points to discuss today. And I wanted to move on now to the reactions to the Declaration of Independence with the Dutch Patriot Revolution. So why don't you talk about the Dutch yeah. Patriot Revolution and how the American Declaration affected that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have that whole history, right, of these merchants being interconnected, print things being published, right, pre-revolution or pre-independence publication. John Dickinson's Letters from a Farmer were published, you know, all these things. So people were aware of this is happening. Merchants were suppressed. The economy was going down. And when the war breaks out, the Dutch get pulled in, right? They get pulled into this war because they are supplying the rebels, right? But they get drawn in a different way too. The British government had a bunch of troops, the Scots Brigade, defending the Dutch Republic since the 1570s, late 1560s. So it was something that Queen Elizabeth I had provided to the Dutch rebels against the Spanish, right, in their war for independence. And they had served to protect the Dutch Republic's borders for two centuries. They were paid for by the Dutch government, but they still swore their oath of loyalty to the monarch of England, right? To the monarch of Great Britain in this case. So the government of Great Britain, looking for troops to fight the American colonies, were like, where do we got troops, right? They went, of course, to Germany, to Hanover, and to the Hessians, right, famously. But they also went to the Dutch Republic because they were like, hey, those are troops. We can get those. The reaction against this was astoundingly negative because the Dutch had already experienced the declining economy. They felt like their merchants were being harassed by British ships, and now they wanted to get troops from our defenses. Not only were they neglecting our defenses, but they were using it against our fellow people in arms fighting for liberty. How could they use that against these liberty-loving Americans, right? And so you have the famous Dutch patriot revolutionary, Johan Derk van de Capelle tot den Pool, or van de Capelle. He was a delegate to an eastern estate. He was a delegate to that states, to that local provincial estates. He leaked his speech to the press saying that the British were extorting the Dutch, that they were taking away their defenses, that they were oppressing us. And just like the Americans, they were using us for their own imperial purposes, and that we must reject this, right? The Dutch must reject this. Now, this was a very successful campaign because the British rescind their offer, in part because also the stadtholders' government was kind of like, we don't want replacement troops. It might be fun for German listeners because they wanted to replace them with Germans. And then the Dutch government, even the stadtholder was like, no Germans, no Germans. which is kind of funny. It was like underlined in the, I had to laugh when I was in the archives because it was very emphatically no Germans defending the Dutch. But this starts this long line of problems, right? So in the 1770s, you have all these disputes. I mentioned the first salute. You have merchants and bankers that start to attach themselves to American interest. John Adams eventually in 1780 visits Dutch Republic, tries to get contacts going with bankers that potentially could finance the American Revolution. As you, as listeners probably know, the American revolutionaries were not, you know, very well funded. They had lots of money problems, right? So they were looking for money, and the Dutch bankers were the best in the business next to London, but they couldn't, obviously couldn't access those funds. And so that leads to all these problems, all these disputes, all these diplomatic engagements. At one point, the Dutch start convoying their merchant vessels. So they actually deploy their navy to protect them against British incursions. This leads to firefights, exchanges. At one point, John Paul Jones, the famous American naval commander, he had captured a British ship. His own ship had sunk. And Benjamin Franklin had told him, if you get into any problems, you go to the Dutch Republic. That's where you'll find safe haven. You'll get your ship fixed. You get your food. You get your stuff. Go there. He did. And the British were just shocked by the response. He entered Amsterdam, and there were people out on the streets cheering him on, writing poems about him, saying how great he was, how he was a hero. Fighting against the British, right? and of course the British ambassador, right? And keep in mind that the Dutch Republic was supposed to be a major ally of the British, right? It was supposed to be, but the whole, everybody was basically saying, well, you know, we hate the British, right? We want to get rid of these guys. And so you see that conflict increase by the time that in the early 1780s, Henry Lawrence, a southern planter, a very rich guy, gets appointed as a delegate, as a commissioner, basically, to try to get a treaty with the Dutch Republic. He gets captured, and his papers are revealed. And what does it say? He throws his papers in the water as he gets captured, but the British fish it out of the sea, and they open up his papers. And what do they find? A draft treaty between the Dutch Republic and the United States. Now, this was done by private people, this treaty, but the British believe that this is, in fact, what's going to happen, right? That the Dutch were secretly negotiating with the Americans, that they were trying to exploit it as they had always done. The British think this is the last straw. They withdraw their ambassador, declare war. War breaks out. The Fourth Anglo-Dutch War in late 1780. Now, as this is happening, the Dutch patriot movement that starts to sort of come up, right, that sort of starts to merge with this pro-American sentiment led by Van der Capella, they see this war as a, like a turning point, right? They see this as a turning point to really make the Dutch Republic a pro-American place where they put in the same kind of reforms that they also want to restore liberty, right? So he writes a pamphlet called To the People of the Netherlands, Aan het Volk van Nederland. And he writes, it's kind of in terms of its impact, though not its content, but in terms of its impact, it's very comparable to Common Sense in the sense that it really energized the movement. It was visceral. I mean, if you think Thomas Paine's extreme in his rhetoric, I mean, Van der Capella basically said that the stadtholder was cheating on his wife, was an alcoholic. I mean, he really went far. Although, unlike Paine, he did not say that we shouldn't have a stadtholder, which is interesting. But he did thought that the stadtholder himself, you know, was absolutely terrible. But he says, right, in this long pamphlet, he says, and it was anonymous, just like Paine's, he says, we need to form militias. We need to send delegations. We need to block the stadtholder. Arm yourselves, just like the Americans have done. Arm yourselves, right? And so that is what happens. So in the early 1700s to mid-1780s, Dutch patriots start to create militias, sometimes called exercitiegenootschappen, kind of like exercise communities, I guess, or societies, or vrijkorps, so a free corps. And they start organizing themselves. They start to take over local governments. One by one, these cities and provinces fall to patriot control, and the stadtholder fears this. He, even though they don't say they want to get rid of him, but he's losing control over these local cities, local councils, where he used to have a lot of privileges. He flees to the east, close to Germany, flees to the east. And then there's like hints of civil war. Like people think, okay, this is going to get, because he controls certain armed forces, but the Dutch Patriots also did, right? So there was this standoff. There's a minor skirmish. And eventually Wilhelmina, who was of Prussia, and it was the wife of Stadtholder William V. And she thinks, maybe I should negotiate with these guys. Maybe I can get them to, you know, get them to get peace and sort of lay down their arms. So she goes, she gets arrested at Gouda, or actually Goejan Verwellesluis near Gouda. And she gets arrested by Patriot militia. She's exposed to a drawn sword. She's not allowed to relieve herself in private, right? A great dishonor. And people, you know, she was like, wow, you know, this is like, they exposed to it. You know, you can't do that to a lady, right? And so she eventually gets released and she writes to her family, the king of Prussia, right, to the Prussian monarch, saying, hey, you know, these guys are out of control. They dishonored me. And my husband is no longer in command here. You need to come in and restore order. That's exactly what happened. The Prussians mobilize, go on the Dutch border. They say, hey, you guys need to, you know, lay down your arms because this ain't working. The Patriots say, we are not going to do that. The Prussians invade. All the Patriot militias collapse upon themselves. And the stadtholder's power gets restored with the help of the Prussians. But what you see happening in this revolution is a longing for an American-type system, right? You see them citing Second Amendment-like sections of American state constitutions. The right to bear arms. Exactly. Yes, that's right. That's right. They put that in their pamphlets, right? They literally cite this stuff. And they see this moment as an event of great economic revival, right? Because remember, in the last 18th century, the Asia trade had sort of gone down, but the Atlantic trade, all this smuggling, kind of started to make money, right? So they thought that this was going to be a big golden age. In fact, and this is a great story, the Dutch patriots, because they connect themselves, these militias, they connect themselves to all these old medieval guilds, the Coopers, all these guys. In Enkhuizen, which is a port town, they align themselves with the fishermen. And it's great. These fishermen, they're looking for new markets, right? And they think, well, the Americans, right? We made a deal with these guys. Because they make a treaty, you know, they recognize American independence, they give loans, right? So they think, oh, these Americans, it's like this grand, big country, you know, they need fish, right? So they send kegs of herring to all these American revolutionary leaders, also Washington, right? They send a keg of herring to George Washington, accompanied with a letter. And von der Capella, the leader, he, you know, he contributes as well. Everybody sort of tries to get this stuff. And they send these kegs of herring, right? And Washington receives this keg of herring, and he's, you know, it's the 18th century. You're supposed to be kind, and you know, you're supposed to reply with a nice letter, right? And so he sends a nice letter back saying, you know, this is great stuff. You know, I'm really glad you guys sent this. And, you know, we are very happy to be in mutual engagement with the Dutch. It's going to be a great relationship. But I don't think that we need your fish because we got a lot of it ourselves. So the moment where they're sending the herring, it doesn't really work, right? But in terms of the marketing. But you see how enthusiastic they are about this American market and about this access to the American market. And it doesn't go anywhere because A, the British are the biggest American trading partner after independence, and B, the Dutch Patriot Revolution fails.
Okay, and that's really interesting because here we see another example of the American Declaration of Independence spreading around the world and influencing other patriot movements elsewhere.
Yep.
Okay, so we're coming to the end, as I ask all my guests. Matthias, here we are 250 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence and its release. What are your big takeaways as a historian, as a Dutchman as well?
My central point here is I think that the anniversary of American independence is a great moment to reflect on the value of liberty in society. This was a cause that obviously they were trying to advance, that's central to the Declaration of Independence. And I think it is our duty, as Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, to reflect on that legacy of liberty and see how we can further advance that in the society we have today.
Professor Matthias Thielemann, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.